4 o'clock or so is a diner's wasteland. Nothing's open, it's between services, and those few places that do stay open continuously go through shift chains, so you spend countless minutes being ignored while the bartender restocks his wine for the evening service, and a busboy resets tables, and you can hear a dishwasher on the intercom in the kitchen yelling down to the cooks, "Here's a ticket! Here's a ticket!" But this is my favorite time of day to eat well, to eat long, luxurious meals with high-end wines. I have eaten staff meal in restaurants at odd hours my whole life, and now I am geared to have my main meal at 4:30. It's the new 8:30 as far as I'm concerned. Every week or so, an outraged woman or somebody's grim personal assistant trying to get an 8:30 reservation at Prune scoffs at our offer of 6 p.m., which we more generally have available, saying, "Who eats at 6 o'clock? Amateurs. Amateurs eat at 6. It may be amateur, but a restaurant at an early hour is my kind of joint. Maybe especially with Michele, as we were always just leaving the beach around then, and we would ride the motorcycle to Astoria and have a late lunch of grilled fish, octopus, scordaglia, and a bottle of Retsina. Or at 4 o'clock, we were scratching at the door of Bar Veloce for 2 sweet salami tramezzini and 2 hot speck panini and a bottle of Grüner Veltliner. After, there was still time for an 8 o'clock movie. This was all during courtship, though, and I think my attachment to a 4 o'clock lunch is about clinging to a past, a deep nostalgia for a time when we rode motorcycles, drank Negronis, and smoked cigarettes. But here we are in a Volvo station wagon, fitted with not one but 2 child seats, the motorcycles long ago sold or stolen, and our responsibilities commensurately graver than they've ever previously been. I have worked very late the previous night and didn't get home until 3 in the morning. I was awoken by the littler one, Leone, at 7:30, a mere 4 hours after I had put my head down on the pillow. I've had coffee, but no breakfast, and now we are in trouble. Code red. Michele, who eats indiscriminately and in his good-natured Italian way thinks everything is nice and good, tries to get me to pull over and park and go to one of the pretentious restaurants on Smith Street, that minor league stretch of Brooklyn that always disappoints, and I just can't. I would rather starve and kill my children, Medea-like, than eat the truffle oil omelet with chorizo foam and piquillo peppers at Soleil or Bluebird or whatever those restaurants are called on that stretch. And that's where we find ourselves, at that particular impasse. Michele trying to get me fed and me putting my foot down, with 2 whining children in the back seat. I am shouting shit into the back seat of the wagon that I'm not proud of, and that would make it hard for anyone, to be attracted to me if they heard me shouting. When suddenly Michele tells me to pull over at the bus stop and turn on the hazards. "What?" I say. "Go," he says, pointing. We are in front of a pork store on 5th Avenue. As soon as I get in the door, I can smell that it's a good one. It's a knockout. The smell of cured Italian meats and scamorza and dried oregano hits me as soon as I enter, and immediately I feel warm fluid resume its course through my spine and my veins, and I realize I am in fact made of blood, warm blood, and I can't believe how perfect Michele can be. He has a way, frequently, of letting a crisis build to its peak and then just casually dropping in front of you exactly what you want and need when you most want and need it. The meat cases are 8 feet long and packed, and there are 3 of them. I've thrown on the hazards, left the kids howling and their dad coping in the back seat, and run into this old school place where big Italian-American guys in flannel shirts under their long white coats make huge sandwiches with mortadella, soppressata, prosciutto, salami, capicola, and the works of marinated peppers, mozzarella, and pitted chopped olives. They use good olive oil and good semolina rolls. I'm watching the guys slice the meat to order. I've got my eye peeled out of one corner for a traffic cop and out of the other for the meat slicer man to get on with it already with his artisanal, neighborly Italian manner. He's taking the customers one at a time, making light neighborhood conversation. I smile, keeping quite still, while in my mind an unkind monologue runs, until at last, the guy hands over 3 meat-packed sandwiches that weigh so much my blood sugar creeps back to normal just from happily holding them. I'm back in the car in a heartbeat, hazards flashing, and doling out sandwiches. I pass the mozzarella and prosciutto one into the back seat while I start wolfing my mortadella. Michele asks if I got anything to drink, and I'm chagrined. I feel like an ass. I didn't even think about something to drink. Should I go? He asks. I say, whatever, a water or something, as he hoists himself out of the back seat, climbs over the car seat with Leone sleeping in it. How did he manage that? And stumbles out the car door. He spills out onto the sidewalk and disappears into a corner store for a few minutes. I don't even pay attention. I am shoving meat sandwich into my face and giving scraps to Marco as fast as I can. Michele returns. He climbs awkwardly back into his spot in the back seat between the two car seats. The B63 bus pulls up alongside us, forced away from the curb and the bus stop by my double parking. The bus spits out its hydraulic steam, lowers, and the passengers walk around the back of the Volvo and make it onto the bus. Michele presses into my hand an ice-cold beer in a can, and we sit there for a full, leisurely, inappropriate 25 minutes, hazards blinking, forcing the bus and its patrons to accommodate us while we eat meat sandwiches and drink beers at 4 o'clock in the afternoon. While the elderly and infirm struggle to get on the bus, I've never been happier. Leone is asleep, his fatigue finally trumping his fear of death. Marco is buried quietly in his own bits of sandwich. And Michele and I, with no silverware and only our open paper wrappers on our laps, sit double-parked with the hazards blinking in a public bus stop, grinning while eating Italian sandwiches and drinking beer. And I would swear to all that I've never met a better guy than this one that I've been cursing and loathing for the past bloody hour and the past 5 years. Chapter 20. We were in the car service minivan, Michele and I and our two kids, and I was sitting in the broken seat, trying to balance without tipping back as we headed to the airport. Somehow we had survived another winter and were headed out for our one shared pleasure, the annual vacation in Italy. The driver had the radio on, blaring mariachi, as well as his dispatch radio making loud static ocean storm noises. He hung a Honduran flag from his rearview mirror along with a strawberry pine tree air freshener that poisoned the fresh July afternoon air blowing in the open windows. In my handbag, I had our expensive tickets to Italy, $5,000 worth of tickets now that each kid is too big to fly free and requires his own seat. We were riding to the airport in happy isolation, a kid in each lap, the Honduran driver going too fast for me. I was feeling close to Michele, the bags all packed with fresh and clean clothes neatly folded, full bottles of toiletries neatly arranged in Ziploc bags, swimsuits bundled in with sweatshirts and cotton t-shirts. 3 weeks of vacation, now ours. Our driver blew through Bed-Stuy, Bushwick, Brownsville, then East New York. People sat on their stoops, hung heavily from windows of tenement buildings, cooked little makeshift barbecues on their fire escapes. I thought of how far from this we would soon be, stomping through the olive tree orchard with the naked kids in nothing but sandals, and eating Michele's mother's delicious boiled zucchini, her buttery olive oil, her harsh but addictive homemade vinegar. Michele and I can and do spend the entire year isolated from and unknown to each other. But as soon as we get in that car on the way to the airport, we smile at each other with a kind of bond, and we are unified, however briefly, by a nostalgia for the moment about to come. July in Italy. Happy? I ask. He smiles as if guilty of something, but only says, huh, a kind of grunt with raised eyebrows, which I now know means abbastanza, good enough, the highest degree of happiness he can allow himself to experience. Italians are suspicious of American exuberance. We ride a bit more in silence. The kids are babbling some crap between them, Leone particularly excited about all the trees as we pass the Jackie Robinson Parkway. Trees! 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 He points and yells. The sun is turning red and heavily slanted, our evening flight to 3 full weeks of Italian vacation as near as night. Michele says, I was thinking, and then pauses. I don't look at him, but I am fully attentive, expectant. It never, ever ends how I wish it would, how I fantasize it will. but I nonetheless always imagined the rest of these started sentences. Ever since I understood that I was actually married, I have hoped for it to be everything I think a real marriage should be, an intimacy of the highest order. In the few moments between the beginning and end of the sentence, I was thinking. I have readied myself, unnecessarily, for luminous pearls of his inner life, some word from his heart, some revelation of what he thinks about or fears or loves or agonizes over, which never arrives. Nonetheless, hope dies hard, and I still become alert in that brief pause in the Honduran minivan, and I imagine the sentence ending with him finally saying, "I was thinking about hosting a dinner party this year in Leuka." But as we hit the Belt Parkway, he finishes instead with this: "The new iPhone is only $299. In all of the years we have spent together, all of the 8-hour car rides, the hours waiting together at airports, in transatlantic flight, in hospital rooms, the long silent hours at night when the kids are asleep and we are stuck in the same room together, all of the winter beaches we have sat on looking out at the oceans, he has never, incredibly, incomprehensibly, said anything important to me. When he said he was thinking about the new iPhone, in spite of having a rather new iPhone right now, this very moment, already in his pocket, I dissolved irrevocably. I lost the first 15 days of my vacation with that iPhone comment. I lost my vacation to a seething, hot black rage that crawled up the back of my neck and covered my head and nose and mouth until I was suffocated by it and could barely breathe and certainly could not speak or make eye contact. It's true, I tend to run a little hot. And that is how I lost 15 of my sorely needed, hard-earned vacation days, and how I robbed him of his. I became speechless and impenetrable for 15 days. He couldn't reach me, and I couldn't be reached, and that ended our vacation before it even got off the ground. You never know when this kind of internal defeat is going to overcome you. Once I saw an older woman fall down on the subway as the train lurched out of the station and she landed on her ass. We all jumped to her aid, distressed to see this older, tired, heavy woman brought down by the careless, jerky transit driver. But she ignored us and our efforts to recover her as quickly as possible to an invulnerable, collected, and standing position. She waved away our eager grapplings to get her up out of this humiliating and embarrassing position. She remained flat on her ass on the dirty floor of the train, looking deeply exhausted, and she sat that way, fully present in her defeat, until we came to a halt at the next stop, and she quietly and methodically lifted herself back up and took a seat on the bench. And I swam in it, too, on this particular day, unable to any longer pretend that our bags of neatly packed, fresh, clean clothes and swimsuits were a symbol of anything greater, of any kind of fresh start and clean slate. I relished my defeat. I said to myself, "I am no match for you, anger and fatigue and loneliness. I am only able to do what I am able to do, and I cannot nurse the infants, mother the toddlers, last 2 whole years without deep sleep, work one of the Surgeon General's most stressful jobs, live in an unhappy marriage, carry the bulk of the finances, and suffer the idea of a new technology toy for you, husband. And so today is the day I have run out of American can-do spirit, and today I am not making or faking July in Italy with my Italian husband." Our ritual meal of Wok Express fast food Chinese at the airport before we will not see anything approximating Asian food, even such as this bullshit chicken broccoli on a styrofoam plate, for 21 days, was shared perfunctorily and, worst of all, politely. We shared the beer on the rocks with icy routine while harnessing the two squirming, high-strung kids. Beer on ice before 9 p.m. is something for us. It's almost a conversation for us. Beer on ice, for example, does not happen like at 3 o'clock on a Tuesday between lunch and dinner service at the restaurant, with only an hour to get the kiddie dinner rolling and the tubby ready before heading back to work. When Michele shows up with 2 beers and 2 glasses of ice, it says, suggestively, that we have time. Time to sit for a minute. Time to sleep off the alcohol should we feel it. Time to lie down with each other. And we drank the beer on ice in Terminal C, as usual, as we had every year before our flight. But it was not with a grinning, quiet excitement, shimmering with sexual promise, freedom, youth, all the things that a couple of beers makes us remember. Beer? He asks, proffering one as usual, because he has not yet caught on that I have dropped out. Yes, please. Thank you. When I am polite with Michele is when we are at our deadliest, when he is nothing more to me than a one-off customer at my restaurant where my professional courtesy is required, when I don't even have the warmth and friendliness I can easily conjure for a beloved regular at the restaurant. When I am yes, please, and no, thank you, is when we are dead in the water. I've grown ambivalent about this annual trip to Italy as it is. Perhaps this is in direct proportion to questions I have about my continued stamina for the marriage itself. As early summer arrives and everyone's casual conversation turns to vacation, the hairdresser, the meat man, the exterminator, they all ask, "Are you going to get away this summer? Any plans?" And I answer matter-of-factly now, without animation. "Yep, I'm going to Italy for the month of July. We go every year. My husband is Italian, and we go every year to his home and his family in Italy." And the meat man, the hairdresser, the exterminator, they light up as if plugged in. Eyes widen with delight and envy. Huge smiles. They burst as I did the very first time I went. Italy! Oh my God, that's fantastic! 3 weeks in Italy! While I still share much of this delight, after the first few years, it's no longer an unmitigated joy. I want to have seen much of the world before I bite the dust. I want to know more of Italy than the apartment in Rome and the crumbling old house in Puglia. I want to be with friends or people I can really talk to on my 21 days of vacation. To take the same one vacation every year with someone I don't get along that well with, while much of the rest of the world remains unexplored and unknown by us, makes me a little less joyful than the exterminator. That we also only go from the house to the same beach or to the same swimming pool every day while we're in Puglia makes me less electrified than the meat man. I like to be anchored by routine, not shackled by it. What I love about Italians is exactly what I also don't love, the incredible fastening down of routine, tradition, the nearly pathological preservation of habit. I love that they haven't torn down the ruins to make a highway, that the pasta is still made the same way, that certain foods are eaten only in certain places in certain preparations. Trippa milanese is always milanese, and trippa alla romana is always alla romana. This is so reliable and rich and fascinating. This is how countries older than ours become so rich in tradition. Repetition, centuries of repetition. But it's that very repetition that makes my heart sing a little wanly when I think of my one vacation a year. Shouldn't we be on a houseboat on the Mekong River Delta this year, eating raw octopus head in Tokyo, strolling the boulevards of Buenos Aires, bicycling the coast of Portugal? It's exactly the same when I tell people that I am married to an Italian. An Italian? Oh, from Italy. An Italian? And they are agog. Does he cook with you at the restaurant? And I laugh. No, he's a doctor. Well, then they are just about levitating. Even I am seduced by the idea of it. An Italian doctor. 3 weeks in Italy. The images I conjure when I hear myself or anyone say 3 week vacation in Italy are probably the same as theirs. I imagine hiking the trails of the Cinque Terre, cooled by the clean, fresh wind from the crystal sea, stopping for fish and wine, so local that you've been tripping over the vines all afternoon on your hike, from that very hillside. I imagine inhaling truffles in Piemonte, going to a wild boar festival in Umbria, sitting in Campo di Fiore sipping a perfect Negroni, one solid ice cube, the glass poured only two-thirds full in the true aperitivo correctness. Having a tight espresso in the late afternoon at San Eustachio, looking up at the antlered deer and the cross atop the church. I imagine my Italian husband in a deep orange summer cashmere sweater playing off his tan, his good wristwatch strapped to his left wrist with a dark leather strap, showing me, why not, some spontaneous and deeply felt affection and warmth. But my actual Italian is in an untucked t-shirt with the Apple computer logo and a pair of khaki shorts from the Gap hanging down mid-calf like frat boys wear. He's got 3 days of razor stubble, having decided not to shave but twice a week, since during the academic year when he is teaching, he must scrape that Gillette twin blade over his face every damn morning. He is resisting, with his black eyes and a pained face, to take us down to show our kids the Fontana di Trevi because, he complains, it's so hot, and because we will have to take a public bus, and because there will be tourists. When the Puglia nighttime sky is lousy with stars, and I fantasize lying down on our backs on the terrace, the stone still hot from the day's long hours of sun, to let them rain down over us, I find Michele sitting on the terrace hunched in his chair, glowing in his wireless connection, and he's Google mapping on his laptop computer the very constellations he could just, by tilting his head back and looking up, practically inhale. Alone on the terrace looking up at the stars, I would not feel lonely. With him glued to the screen, I feel gutted as I lay on my back by myself in awe of the sky. But it sounds better when I say, yes, the month of July in Italy with my Italian husband. Because I like the watercolor image better than the reality, and because I can't stand to be the kind of difficult person, the one unimaginable hag on the planet who is capable of not totally enjoying a month in Italy and who could not be totally levitated by the idea of her doctor Italian husband, I just sit in the hairdresser's chair and say, yep, Italy. We go every year. My husband is Italian. With this ambivalence, our flight is announced and we head to the gate. Michele's brother, Giovanni, meets us at Fiumicino Airport at 9 a.m. It is already hot and the punishing white light of day assaults our bleary eyes. Michele and I are exhausted from a long sardine-packed transatlantic flight with a fussy pair of kids who couldn't settle properly in spite of the Benadryl we popped them. We have hissed at each other, each criticizing the other's strategy for taming the 2- and 4-year-old beasts. We have never agreed about pacifying the kids. Michele, in his excitement to be home, bolts quickly ahead toward the line of Italian people waiting to meet their arriving relatives, while I straggle and struggle along behind, hauling the little one and trying to push the heavy cart with all of our luggage. One of the wheels is malfunctioning, making me slow and hobbled. Michele does not look back. He has Marco on his shoulders, I have Leone, and a mountain of luggage. Giovanni emerges from the line, ducking under the barrier, and runs to help me. Michele says to his brother, "She doesn't want help." And I can't imagine how I've been so misunderstood all of these years. Yes, I want help. I kiss Giovanni lightly on both cheeks, left cheek first with the Italians, I finally learned. He has let his hair grow out, salt and pepper gray almost to his shoulders, and his eyebrows seem equally as long and ungroomed. Michele greets him by teasing him unkindly about his haircut, or lack of one, and laughs high and long. Ando, their sister's teenage son, has also come to greet us and to help us, and this year he has become fully a man, with every ounce of testosterone he's been allotted in full surge. He has real shoulders, a deep voice. He even reeks of the cigarette he just finished. At 17, he has definitely had sex. Michele greets him also by insulting him about his poor grades at school and his failure to pass 2 of his subjects. Long, high-pitched laughter. I live in close proximity to this man all year long, and I am accustomed to this backhanded reverse psychology, this way of actually saying, "I am so happy to see you. I am so glad to be home. My family and country mean so much to me." But I am always taken aback in the first few minutes of arriving into the fold of the Fortis family that no one protests or bursts into tears. I would and do fall apart with such starvation for genuine affection and sincerity, for one crumb of the true contents of this man's heart and mind. Yet no one but me winces. For the past few years, I drive the car into Rome from the airport. Michele is better at handling the kids in the back of the car, and I am better at driving. Or at least this is what we have learned to cheerfully and constructively say to each other. It is a Saturday morning, and the autostrada is relatively empty. as are the streets of Rome. The city has clusters of tourists, like overripe grapes, at every crosswalk, but the plague of wasps, the Romans on their Vespas, feels thin and hardly mortifying. I shift, accelerate, switch lanes, and take the corners as if I lived here year-round. We pass ruins of aqueduct, Colosseum, and then wind down the hill around the fountain and the statues. Some of the tourists already have sunburn on their sleeveless shoulders, though it is not yet 11 in the morning. This is 7 years later with two kids, no nighttime tour through Rome on the back of a lover's motorcycle, but even so, hands down, this is the most beautiful city on earth, even in broad daylight with a remote husband who's actually considering buying a new iPhone. I love Rome. We pull up in front of the large gate to the apartment and park under the tree out of the intense sun. Every single year we do this. The neighborhood is quiet, sleepy, intensely residential, and lately, too civilized for me. Not one soul smokes on a balcony, suns themselves on a terrace, or reads a paper on a front stoop. The shutters are all closed, but for a few windows of a few scattered apartments all around the adjoining and neighboring buildings. There is no music emanating from any apartment, no blare of a television. There are no children. Michele's sister Manuela and his mother greet us from the balcony overhead. They look just exactly the same as last year, and for a moment it seems as if the reports from Rome all winter about Alda's failing health and failing memory have been exaggerated. It seems as if they haven't moved from the very spot where we waved goodbye last summer at the end of our vacation. I feel genuinely happy to see them both. I really love them. In our hug, Alda always says to me, "Come sei brava, Gabrielle. Proprio brava. Che coraggio." And I always well up in this shower of her kindness. She is forever complimenting me on what courage and strength I have to haul the two kids across the ocean and deliver them to her doorstep. She herself has a magnificent fear of flying. Manuela, always maternal and sympathetic, says, "Stanchissima sei." And then she repeats, "You must be very tired," in English, which she speaks perfectly. The apartment in Rome where we spend the first couple and last few days, the bookends, of our annual vacation, is the whole ground floor of a large, good-looking building that has been separated into two apartments. Manuela lives with her son Ando in one half, a beautiful, sparse, but tasteful apartment of four rooms with a hallway so lined with books in English and Italian and French that they reach the ceiling. And Alda in the other half, with Giulio, an elegant, massive apartment with three bedrooms and two large living rooms that is so packed with family mementos and heirloom silver and sepia photographs and centuries-old heavy furniture and wardrobes stuffed with exquisite linens and lace table covers passed down from great-great-great-grand ancestors that your shoe heel doesn't even click on the marble floors. Echo is immediately absorbed. The tall French doors open onto a huge terrace and front yard where orange trees and Concord grapes grow over a pergola. Orange blossom grows in cascades over the stone railings of the terrace, the fragrance hitting you right in the kisser as soon as you enter. I could fall down drunk from that fresh perfume and lulled by the bubble of the fountain every time we enter through that gate, which clicks heavily behind us as we all go inside. Bud, the golden retriever, has dug holes all over the modest patch of front yard, and there's shit in so many places that has not been cleaned up that I am thinking twice about whether or not I want the kids running around in there with no shoes and no pants, and they always seem to get buck naked within 6 minutes of arriving anywhere, so I will have to decide quickly. The yard is no longer as charming as it was when I was first here, sitting under the pergola of grapes with Michele, having wine, intoxicated by the scent of honeysuckle, oranges, uva fregola, and each other. We hug and kiss Manuela and Alda hello, while Michele's youngest brother Giulio stands at the periphery of the group waiting to greet us. He leans forward and offers his cheek to be kissed, but not to actually be kissed. This I have also finally learned. The dining room table is set exactly as always, with fresh mozzarella, boiled small zucchini, prosciutto and melon, cruets of her olive oil, and red wine vinegar. There is a pot of pasta water boiling on the old propane stove in the kitchen where Manuela is readying to cook some spaghetti. Bud is running around from room to room and out onto the terrace, then back in again, running in and around and over the children, barking with great excitement. Michele yells at Bud, and Manuela yells at Michele, and within minutes, the two of them are fighting about how to discipline the dog. It is one of Michele's habits to conduct himself as if he is the head of the household, in spite of his lack of contribution to it or participation in it year-round. The dog is not his, this house is not his, the daily chores of caring for Giulio as well as caring for Alda, who is now 84 and starting to fail, is not his. And yet within 15 minutes of entering the house, he is scolding the dog and giving Manuela instructions on how to live. This also is the same as every year. Giovanni, meanwhile, has methodically carried every piece of our heavy luggage from the car up the marble steps and into the foyer of the apartment. He has thrown the ball to Bud a few times, had a small avuncular conversation with Ando, whom Manuela raises alone, and now is seated at the dining room table next to Alda, across from me and the kids, sorting out and portioning her many lunchtime pills. Oddly, this is where my full isolation sets in, at the dinner table, surrounded by family and good food. Here, in the very place and the very moment of the grail I've been seeking to recover since my own family evaporated 30 years ago. Everyone is speaking Italian, which I don't really speak. My kids are dislocated and shy and so clingy it is impossible to sit at the table for longer than a moment before one or the other or both drag me away from the strange people, the language they don't quite recognize, the loud and animated quality of the room. Because Michele is deep into reunion with his family, I will be the one who gets up from the table, leaving my plate of food to attend to the children. The image of the Italian family, dining al fresco around a large table, the children running around in the grapevines or the olive trees, is the most seductive image in the world, a moment that exists in Robert Mondavi Vineyard publicity shots in glossy magazines. You are welcome for a plate of spaghetti and a glass of wine, but it is not yours, and it will never belong to you, and you will never belong to it. I spend a lot of time on the terrace with the kids while everyone is inside having lunch and conversation. I, too, have just been through a long and difficult plane ride, am also sleep-deprived, have exerted myself strenuously in the few days just before leaving in order to ready the family for our vacation. And I, too, long for my vacation to start with a fat plate of Alda zucchini and a glass of cold white wine from the Alto Adige and a boisterous catch-up session with my family around the table. That is my image of vacation in Italy. It is my image of being married to an Italian-Italian. It is my fantasy of recovering that fireside night, snug in a sleeping bag surrounded by my brilliant siblings and speaking our own made-up language. But I am reliably alone for the first few days, babysitting on the terrace while my glass of wine warms on the dining room table, where my seat remains empty. My hunger feeds my exhaustion. My exhaustion fuels my sadness. $5,000 worth of plane tickets to wind up alone on the terrace, feeling like the nanny. Later in the afternoon, with the kids zombied out in front of Italian cartoons on the television, I get a chance to speak with Manuela in the kitchen. Michele has told me that you aren't coming with us to Leuca, I ask, disappointed. I will stay here, if you don't mind, she says, always this polite with me, as if she were asking my permission to stay in Rome during the hot weeks of July, while we go down to the house in Leuca with the whole family, including Alda, who has waited eagerly for our arrival so that we can head south together. Of course I don't mind, but I will miss you. Can't I persuade you with the promise of mojitos? I know that Manuela likes my cooking, and she has liked some of the little cocktails I make during the summer for aperitivo. When I have been able to get my hands on mint and limes, not easy in that small town in Puglia, I have made mojitos, and she has loved them. She shows genuine delight at the idea, but she must stay in Rome, she says. Ando must take summer classes, and I must stay here to be with him. So, would it be good if I cook for the family this year? Is that okay? I ask. I had tried to discuss this with Michele before we left New York. I had insisted that we could not possibly arrive as a family of four and expect his mother to cook for us as usual, even with the help of Rosaria. But I was afraid of cooking for his mother, and especially tentative about cooking so much pasta, which the family requires, a skill at which I am not very accomplished. Michele understood and agreed, but answered only with his vague grunt and had not come up with a plan. So I had decided, maybe even on the plane ride over, that I would just take on the responsibility. But still, I needed to check with Manuela, to assume that I might, for a few measly weeks of the summer, take over the kitchen of an Italian family who has lived under the matriarchy of their beloved and revered Alda Fortes de Nito, Mama, for 84 years, seemed extremely delicate to me. "But do you think it will be okay with Alda?" I asked Manuela. "I will need to rearrange some of the furniture in that kitchen." "Yes, I think she will love it. She will want to do some, but not all. She wants to cook, but can't cook all of those meals. It's too much. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner every day for the whole family, and then again all over the next day. It's too much for her. She has stopped even cooking Sunday lunch." "Okay, I understand. I will cook then. But what about Giulio?" Manuela assures me that he will find the new things to eat exciting and interesting. "Alda has stopped cooking Sunday lunch?" I repeat, having missed a few sentences of our conversation. "When will you drive to Leuca?" Manuela asks. "Wait, there's no more Sunday lunch?" Manuela nods sadly. "It's too much for her now." "For 7 years, there's been Sunday lunch. For something more like 65 years, there's been Sunday lunch. But I mean, for me, there has been Sunday lunch for 7 years. In spite of my isolation, my sadness, my long, horrible winters with Michele, I live for Sunday lunch. It's 4/5 of my fantasy life about vacation in Italy each year. Even though I know perfectly well that it is not my Sunday lunch, even though I know that I spend Sunday lunch on the terrace with the kids feeling lonely, even though I barely get a sip of the wine poured at Sunday lunch, I love Sunday lunch. I love the image of the whole family sitting down at the table, and even the arguing and the yelling at the dog seems exquisite in Italian. I say to Manuela, "I will cook Sunday lunch tomorrow. The family and all should come as usual. And on Monday morning, we will all drive to the south. How does that sound?" "Brava," Manuela says. "Va bene." I cook, easily, sepia with green beans and fennel and broken vinaigrette, shell beans with onions and tomatoes and herbs, fried zucchini agrodolce with fresh mint and hot chili flakes, cauliflower with salami and parsley and breadcrumbs, smoked eggplant with garlic and lemon and olive oil. There is plenty at the market in Rome. It is my first day of cooking, and I am full of ideas about what to cook and how to cook. I will use all of their customary ingredients and bend them just toward my style so that everything will be familiar but new simultaneously. To pull off lunch for these 12 people or so feels surprisingly fine. I cook alone in Manuela's kitchen, undisturbed. She has only 3 pots, and I use them all in heavy rotation. And luckily, my kids have slept through the morning on a jet lag schedule, affording the quietude and privacy and distractionless morning to accomplish my task just in time. I am just stepping out of the shower as my kids wake up and everyone arrives for lunch at 2. These first encounters are still exciting. I love to set eyes on everyone again for the first time since last year. I don't know if anyone in the family knows me or likes me, but I like them. Without language, I am left hyper, acutely tuned in to tone and body language, and I can never trust my observations fully. People smile and seem happy to see us. Anna and Carlo, Michele's younger brother and his wife, arrive with one of their daughters. Paolone arrives with Angela. Everyone is here in the way that I love, nostalgically. The big din of Italian people sitting around the table together, drinking wine and eating delicious food. It looks like a page in a magazine. But I am again exhausted and on the terrace with my 2 kids alone, trying to keep them out of the dog shit. Michele comes outside and offers to sit with the kids a while, but even when I go inside and take a place at the table, I feel a gulf between me and the impossibility of what I want, what I crave from this family of which I am still not a part. Alda and Carlo and Manuela and Giulio ask me about every part of the meal, how I cooked each thing, what was in each dish. "Ma la sepia, how did you make them so tender? And what was in the zucchini? How did you think of putting the salami in with the cauliflower?" This is perfect starter conversation for me because I can, in fact, understand in Italian and answer in Italian. It is not difficult for me to say the names of ingredients in Italian. Everyone says they loved the food, and I watched Alda's face intently to see if she was being polite. She seemed genuinely happy with the meal, and the ability to sit and enjoy her family without having to cook. And that is all I give a shit about. Every year I vow to learn to speak this language. Every year I arrive and am completely tongue-tied and disoriented in the first few days. By the end of the first week, I have fully recovered everything I learned the year before, and I can piece sentences together. By week three, I'm more liquid, ready to really learn to speak this language. And just then, we pack our bags with dirty laundry and Salentino pottery and Sorali biscuits and fly home. In the morning, we pack the rented car and drive the 8 hours south to the house in Puglia, without speaking except as it pertains to or involves the kids. Our first few days of vacation in Italy, and I have not left the apartment in Rome once, and Michele and I are starting to spiral like dishwater from cordiality toward the sucking hole of hostility. We arrive at the house. This small seaside town has, curiously, a collection of wild and improbable villas right on the main drag facing the sea, built in the 1800s. In the 200 intervening years since these lavish villas were built, some with turrets and parapets and some, like ours, with rooms with no ceilings, this place has become the Italian Asbury Park. I feel like I'm at the Jersey Shore. A dozen kiosks sell sequined bathing suits and tie-dyed beach wraps. Italian teenagers in mirror sunglasses and thongs up their asses sit on the tide wall and don't look at each other, smoking. A karaoke bar now resides exactly adjacent to the Villa Fortis, and until 2 in the morning each night, we are serenaded by drunk 20-year-olds half-singing Celine Dion songs in thick Italian accents, their mouths forming words they don't know the meaning of into a microphone. There's a sliver of a children's amusement park at the far end of the boardwalk promenade, with rides that go around and around for €5 a pop. The villa still impresses. But whatever money there was has all run out. No one comes by with dusty carts of tomatoes and melons. There are no men working in the mornings to whom we could bring cold beers. There are many dead branches fallen in the driveway, and the gravel is all but washed away. There are so many leaves encroaching from the sides like a riverbed, with the driveway now narrowing like a trickling stream and not the wide boulevard it has been in the past. It needs to be raked, and raked, and bagged and hauled away. It could take most of a week. The high wall that fronts onto the Via Tommaso Fortes, the road name for Michele's great-grandfather, has been vandalized over the winter, and the delicate lattice of stonework, which they smashed with hammers evidently, has been hastily repaired with big, unattractive cinder blocks, laid by an apprentice, it looks like. Michele gets out of the car and spends a long time looking at the wall and shaking his head. Look at these. The kids follow him already barefoot, leaving their crocs scattered haphazardly up the unkempt driveway. Already they are digging in the leaves and the gravel where they will spend many hours in the next days contentedly eating, pissing, digging, and fighting. Here we are. In the morning, I clean out the cabinet. The cabinet houses the mismatched espresso cups, the everyday Pyrex cookware, the coffee itself, breadcrumbs, very, very old spices in very old jars, faded aromaless sage in a black pepper jar, and cloves in an oregano bottle, as well as pasta in bags and boxes. Usually on the third shelf toward the bottom, there are a couple of platters of room temperature food, cooked, if lucky, that morning, but not uncommonly the day before, and even, I've seen it, the day before that. The fried peppers and eggplant and potatoes that rest there have never seen refrigeration, which is on one hand kind of unsettling, but also helps me see how hyper we Americans are about refrigeration. In Alda's house, the refrigerators themselves hardly make 50 degrees, and prepared food rests for days in the cabinet and also in the turned-off oven. Everyone in the family eats this stuff and hasn't died from it yet. As the new temporary surrogate junior helper self-appointed matriarch, or whatever I am here, the first thing I want to do is to prepare the kitchen so that I can cook in it. For some reason, everyone is surprised and there is much commotion and animated consternation when I start pulling out all the mealy moth-infested bags of pasta and rice and old biscotti, which I have been politely noticing but ignoring for the prior 6 years. Everyone seems truly surprised to find these bags teeming with live moths and brimming with the husks of their eggs. A veritable fabric of cobweb-like filament infests all the jars and bags of meal, breadcrumbs, polenta, and hard wheat flour. Moths fly into the room and up, up, up to the top of the 20-foot vaulted ceilings of this villa's old kitchen. I have been aware of this infestation since my first visit here, where it amused me and charmed me. In my third and fourth years, I was maybe less charmed and more skeeved out. But this year, well, I feel completely neutral and unemotional. This shit's gotta go. For my first act as surrogate matriarch understudy or nanny or housekeeper or useful guest, I'll never know what I am in this family. I am chucking the mealy moth-infested crap that I have known to be living in this crazy cabinet since the day I arrived here 7 years ago. I feel it is appropriately respectful to have waited this long, though I admit it was a challenge for me not to have at this cabinet 5 years ago. I put the espresso cups with the espresso cups, the saucers with the saucers, the platters with the platters. On the next shelf, I put the viable pastas in a group, the spices together in a row, and leave one shelf empty to receive the fried peppers and fried potatoes and the fried croquettes that I know Rosaria will put there in the morning when she arrives. I keep an eye on Alda's face, seated at the kitchen table squinting at the newspaper, to see if she hates me already. Giovanni shuffles in and pulls open a drawer crammed so full of corks and bottle caps and bits of string that I start to sweat slightly just looking at the chaos of it. He stands there for 11 or 12 minutes picking through the caps with one finger, looking for the cap to the olive oil jug, before giving up and heaving the heavy drawer shut. At last, we rearrange the kitchen. Giovanni pushes the tables around as I describe, and we take it one piece by one piece. The small table to the corner, the tall granite table to the center in front of the stove and sink, the refrigerator against the wall by the door. Giovanni shakes his head many times, insisting that a certain piece won't fit or can't be moved, but I am not deterred. And I love working with him. Even his stubborn resistance feels collaborative, and he never condescends to me. "Let's just try it," I say. "If it doesn't fit, we can move it all back." Soon, everything sits exactly as I have envisioned it for years, as it should be. There is space for me to work, to produce all these meals, and the family can now sit at the other kitchen table with the newspaper, the coffee pot, the lunch plates, the random screwdriver, suntan lotion, pistachios in the shell, as well as a pile of empty shells, mosquito coils, and the debris that accumulates in this family. Then I go to the market. On this, the first day back in Leuca, I am happy to see some of my old favorites again, the punterelle, the leccese green beans, the small dense zucchini, and the eggplant. I buy big bundles of all of them and lots of peaches and a watermelon. Alda eats fruit after each meal, and I think my kids will eat the watermelon. The meat is dismal as usual, but there is a fish stall with some good-looking stuff. I get an octopus, a branzino, a few pounds of head-on shrimp. At the supermarket, I push the cart slowly up and down each and every aisle, filling it with all of the things I have come to know each person in the family will like. There is bottled iced tea for Michele, and Coca-Cola for Giulio, and fruit juices in cartons that Giovanni and Alda drink. I get some Italian versions of junk food for the kids, just to see what the Italian chips are like. And as I am at the checkout, paying for the cartload on my American Express, I feel potent and capable and maternal. I am taking care of and providing for my family. The checkout girl swipes the card, and for the long minute it takes to dial up to an international satellite that can verify its legitimacy, and by extension, my own, I fall into a moment's emotional slump. I do want to be here. I just want my vacation in Italy with my Italian husband to feel like what it sounds like. I want to do the cooking. It is what grounds me, gives me pleasure, and is the best way for me to communicate with the Italian-speaking family and to make a contribution. But it can also make me feel like the hired help. While Michele babysits the kids at the pool for the day, dozing in and out of naps and reading the newspaper and having fluid conversations with people in his native tongue, I am nagged by an emptiness while I am neatening and organizing the drawers and shelves in all the cabinets. And it continues as I move up and down each aisle in the grocery store, and interferes still while I am chopping each onion at the newly created cooking island in front of the kitchen stove. By the time I check out at the grocery store and I've put this grocery bill on my personal card, sautéed the onions with the potatoes, and wiped down the counter, I feel precariously poised exactly between totally perfect, as if I am exactly where I should be, and totally fucked up, as if I were bankrolling my own martyrdom. If he had ever once finished one of those started sentences as I had always yearned for them to be finished, we may have had a different vacation, a different ending. But at the time, all I could think was, "Dottore, you don't get a new iPhone if I don't get a dinner party." I prepare the octopus as Alda prepares it, with potatoes and onions and a few hot chilies. But when I put it in the serving dish, one of her large old Salentino pottery pieces, she doesn't recognize it. "Gabrielle, che c'è dentro?" What's in there? "Polpo, Alda, e tue ricette, con cipolle, patatas, e peperoncini pauchi, polpo." "It's octopus, Alda, it's your recipe. I learned it from you, with onions and potatoes and a few chilies. It's your octopus." "Con cipolle?" she asks, her brow knit up tight, her black eyes not comprehending. "Sì," I say. "E che altro?" she asks. "And what else?" I repeat, as if saying it for the first time. "Patatas, cipolle, peperoncini." This is Italian I can actually speak, menu Italian. Leone comes running into the kitchen, nearly impaling his head on the corner of the newly situated heavy granite cooking island. Everyone is back from the pool. "Eh, Gabrielle," she finally manages. "Come chiama questo piccolo?" What is this little one's name? "Questo è Leone," I say. "Leone," she cries, her face now flush and bright with recognition and relief. She remembers Leone. "Sì, Leone. Ciao, Leone, tesoro mio. Ciao, piccolo." "Yes, Leone. Hi, Leone, my treasure. Hi, little one." And then she asks me, "Quanti figli ci sono?" How many kids are there? "Due, Alda. Ci sono due, Marco e Leone." This is new this year, this kind of memory loss. She gets a storm across her face, her brow knit so tight, I would like to press my thumbs into the creases and massage them away. "Due figli," she exclaims. "Due?" "Sì, sì," I reply. "Marco e Leone." And she falls silent and brooding for a couple of minutes, sitting at the kitchen table with the telephone in front of her. I wash the puntarelle and tip the green bean standing at the sink with my back to her, affording her, I hope, the privacy in which to experience her frustration and befuddlement and disorientation. Leone runs back out to the driveway to pee in what's left of the gravel. The stove needs to be replaced, but after rearranging the kitchen so that the heavy granite top table is now a cooking island, and the low kitchen table with all the crap on it is pushed against the wall so that people can convene and eat there without getting in the way of the cooking, I feel there is strong and immovable resistance from Giovanni. There is only so much change this family can stand. Throw away the mealy moths and move the kitchen table and call it quits for this year, because this is at the threshold of what they can handle. The Fuertes brothers are practically sweating with nerves. I realize I have already gotten away with as much as I can for this year and will let go of the new stove, but it does not make me comfortable. The grids that rest over the burners have corroded away these past 50 years, and where there used to be four solid prongs over each burner, atop which your pot could sit securely, there are now little stumps and missing legs altogether, so that sometimes you must balance the pot to boil water or fry French fries on two little prongs. The pots themselves, aluminum pieces of crap, as dented and buckled and mangled as little car wrecks, wobble on a perfectly flat surface, let alone on the stump of a burner grid. One 10-quart pasta pot full of boiling water at every meal, and I'm tense, ultra-edgy, when my kids come blasting into the kitchen, clutching my thighs, shrieking, hugging me right where I stand, between the stove and the island, in an apron, with a paring knife in my hand. If that fucking water tips over, we are not close enough, for my comfort, to a pediatric burn ward in this little seaside town, and that is not how I want to spend my vacation. But Giovanni says no, or acts no. He never says no. He just physically will not budge. It's Alda who is invoked as the reason nothing can change or be different. And yet Alda is delighted with the new arrangement of the kitchen. To everyone who visits or telephones, she gushes and gives them a tour, physical or verbal, of the new layout. "Guarda come più grande! Guarda, Ci sono due spazi, uno per mangiare e uno per cucinare. Look how it's bigger now. Look how we now have two separate spaces, one for eating and one for cooking. She seems genuinely thrilled. When I wanted to have a big party, Michele said no, because Mama would be overwhelmed and exhausted. When I wanted to build a fire out near the front garden to cook a lamb outdoors, Michele said no, Mama won't like it. But it's Mama who pulls up the first chair and watches as I build the fire on a tiny makeshift grill and as I put the 3-pound branzino stuffed with lemons and fennel branches over the coals. It's Mama who stays out until 1 in the morning at the big party at Sergio and Mercedes' house, worrying her sons who have stayed at home, and who then, upon returning home, sits at the kitchen table and wraps it with her crutch gently, calling for un goccetto, a little drop. Giovanni, with his long wavy eyebrows like Spanish moss mingling with his long wavy hair, repeats in amazement and admiration at his mother, at Mama, un goccetto voi? A drop you want? Alda beams back at him, spirits high. In unison, Michele and Giovanni repeat, disbelieving, un goccetto. Perché no? She asks. And Michele laughs genuine, happy laughter. He loves this woman with all of his heart and mind. There is nothing abbastanza about it. This is the woman he loves. This is the woman he hoped to find in me when he first looked into the restaurant and saw me at the stove. In classic Italian style, the brothers fumble around the kitchen, saying it again several times while shaking their heads and smiling. Un goccetto, and Giovanni finally pulls from the refrigerator a bottle of wine. It is Alda who is singing the song of this new kitchen layout. It is Alda who stays out late at the party. Giovanni pours us all 2 sips of Salentino Rosé, and we sit at the kitchen table for a few minutes before going to bed. This woman, this magnificent woman, is not the one who fears change. 2 weeks later, I am hunting through the local market, scanning each vendor's crates, desperate to discover something new to cook. My jaw tightens, and I'm grinding my molars a bit at all this eggplant. In Leuca, there is nothing but eggplant. Local, seasonal. These are the words that turn everybody on these days, but 21 days of local eggplant season is torture. I think when people get all dreamy about local and seasonal, they are thinking of California, where you can get anything any time of year. But they are not referring to Santa Maria di Leuca, a small seaside town at the tip of the heel of the boot of Italy in the state of Puglia. And they are not imagining eating that way, local and seasonal, for 21 days straight. They know they can go get a platter of sushi at their local joint any night of the week. Maybe they are thinking of their week-long trip to Tuscany. I am grateful for the burrata, to be sure. We have eaten so much of the creamy, fresh cheese, often still warm from the caseificio, and it is so sweet and tender that I have not tired of it in the least. In fact, I have finally understood that we will not be eating burrata in the U.S. anymore, because even the best that you can get at Agata and Valentina, fresh off the airplane, is not it. You can't eat burrata in the States because it can't stay fresh long enough to make the journey. It is always a hair sour and just starting to harden, and it turns watery and off, no matter how just flown in from Bari, the wholesaler at Murray's, insists it is. But still, I craved some arugula to go with it, some broccoli rabe even. To Alda, I said, is there arugula even anywhere? But Alda shook her head and tisked, non è stagione, non è stagione, not the season. In the shade of the tree in front of the old school that sits on the market square, I see my old man. My spirits lift to see my vecchio, the old Benton half-farmer with his pants held up by twine, but even he has only a few eggplants, 4 lonely eggs, and some incredibly small dried white beans and a knotted plastic bag in the wagon of his ape. I buy the eggs and the beans. I am running out of eggplant ideas. I have roasted it with harissa and caraway. I have smoked it with garlic and lemon and parsley. I have fried it with egg and breadcrumbs. I have quickly pickled it, sort of, with Alda's rough red wine vinegar and green onions. The beans might be a nice jump start to my imagination. But when I soak them later and start to skim off the dried skins which are floating to the top of the pot, I notice that there is a brown spot on each pea. I split one open with my fingernail, and inside is a larval shell of a tiny worm. I split open another, and it holds another larval shell. And on I go, splitting each tiny bean, until I realize that the whole kilo is bad with worms. "Imbroglione," Alda cries when I show her the beans and tell her from whom I bought them. There is only a week left of my vacation, and I am falling apart from maintaining my chill with Michele, who has, oddly, perhaps in being faced with his failing mother, started to call me Mama as well. He has always had difficulty saying my name. He kind of chokes on it, stumbles on it, but this is new, this calling me Mama. With a tremendous fervor, since the day of the birth of Marco, Michele has taken to fatherhood so completely, so thoroughly, that it has become his priority to the exclusion of all other relationships, including our romantic one. This new habit of calling me Mama sips the very last lungful of air from our romance. I'm also falling apart from nothing but eggplant at the market since we arrived, from trying to strike a balance between cooking what I'd like to eat and cooking what Alda would like to eat. Alda has started to give me instructions while I am cooking and seems no longer quite so pleased to have all the cooking done for her so she is free to enjoy her family around the table. I cook a pot of mussels to tender perfection, and she says, Gabrielle, non credi sono crudi? Don't you think they're still a bit raw? I don't, obviously. I think they are all open, tender, and perfectly cooked, but I say, should I cook them a little longer? 5 minutes, she says. After each 5 minute interval, she suggests another until I have cooked the mussels to rubbery bits 15 minutes later, and she is satisfied with the results. It's the last straw that my beloved Vecchio sold me shitty, wormy beans. Giovanni digs around in the heavy drawer once more, still searching, 15 days later, for the right cap for the olive oil jug. To me, he seems insane. This repeated, futile search for a thing that doesn't exist in a drawer full of promising crap is my definition of insanity. But of course, that is just the mechanism of hope itself. And it's not lost on me that I've been doing the exact same thing, in a way, digging around in that drawer looking for something that doesn't exist. It's promising and seductive, that huge Italian family, sitting around the dinner table, surrounded by the olive trees. But it's not my family, and I am not their family, and no amount of birthing sons and cooking dinner and raking the leaves or planting the gardens or paying for the plane tickets is going to change that. If I don't come back in 11 months, I will not be missed, and no one will write me or call me to acknowledge my absence. Which is not an accusation, just a small truth about clan and bloodline. To Giovanni, I seem insane. I spend a quick 15 minutes before starting to cook each day, tidying up the cyclone debris of scattered toys and toy parts and single shoes and old dried bits of half-eaten toast that my kids have scattered about in each room. He laughs at me as I am bent over picking up little pieces of a miniature Italian soccer team. "Why do you bother?" he smiles. 15 minutes after they get back from the pool, it will be exactly like this again. I stand up. "Yeah, Giovanni, that's right. But I also brushed my teeth this morning, even though I know perfectly well that I will have to brush them again tonight." Michele is getting ready for a day at the pool with the kids, loading up his insulated bag with iced tea and frozen water and prosciutto for lunch, while I am sitting here with wormy beans, a craving for arugula, radishes, scallions, well-marbled beef, cilantro, avocados, and other more spiritual impossibilities. And somehow, I don't even remember how, our 15-day frost heaves. In a flash, we are yelling at each other in the kitchen, our first real conversation with each other since the taxicab to the airport, if you can count that as a conversation. And we're having it in my preferred, if vulgar, style, at full pitch, with his mother and two brothers sitting at the kitchen table. In English, our only form of privacy, if language can be considered that way, he yells, "Why didn't you just say so?" And then he lectures as if educating me. "Eat so easy," he says. "Eat so easy to just say, enough with the new iPhone." We could have avoided this 15-day war. And in that moment, I find it impossible to explain to him that it's not about the iPhone. Easy for somebody, but impossibile for me. Alda wants to see the sea. The rest is a pity to her. The badly repaired front wall, the fallen dead branches, the dry dead garden, the leaves crowding out the driveway. The electricity that fails, the doorknobs that fall off, the burners on the stove worn away to nothing. But the rest is not as imperative as sitting on the front terrace overlooking the sea and actually being able to see the sea. The oleander trees in front have grown so tall over so many years that, while beautiful, they nonetheless suffocate the house and obscure the incredible wide-open vista of the sea. I, like Alda, have been wanting to sit on that terrace and see the sea since we've been coming here. It's silly. You can stand on the terrace and look out at the sea, but as soon as you sit down with your Negroni, you look straight ahead into a thicket of branches and pink and white flowers. Like the mealy moths in the cabinet, I've been quietly noting the fact that Michele has a villa, an actual giant villa by the actual sea in Italy, Italy, from which you cannot see the sea because the oleander trees have grown over so thickly and tall. You feel stupid sitting on that old splintered patio furniture, looking straight ahead into an encroaching jungle of soft branches, beyond which we can hear, smell, and feel the sea, the gentle breeze tinkling the mast cables and rings of all the boats in the marina, but we can never see the sea when we sit on the terrace. Unexpectedly, I find myself offended by this. This casual nonchalance at the demise of great wealth, this effortless letting go of the last of what's left. Giovanni's quiet and easy submission to the force of entropy. Michele's willingness to let me go. The trees fall, the walls crumble, the doorknobs fall off. Easy come, easy go. The way I'm wired, with my Protestant dishwasher's mentality, I bristle at the passivity, the way they just roll over and let defeat pat them on the head. If I had this incredible asset, this wealth just handed to me, I would take obsessive, scrupulous care of it. I would mend the fence myself, prune back the trees, oil the locks, take a second job, set aside $40 a week for a garden rake and seed packets and some soil. The property sags and crumbles each year, subject to weather and vandals, and no one puts up a fight. Michele warns me it would be offensive to his mother, who is legally and bodily the owner until she passes, to display any proprietary care for the place. The art and furniture and objet have been robbed and burgled so thoroughly over the years that the villa feels empty enough to rent. But Michele walks around barefooted, checking his email on Wi-Fi, leaving a juice glass or an espresso cup wherever he forgets it, as if the domestic staff were still about to show up. He seems to not have realized yet that there is no man coming to cut down the branches and rake the driveway. There is no Swiss au pair coming to take care of the kids. The aristocracy is over. But Donna Alda wants to sit on the terrace and admire the sea from her chair. Besides the fact that I happen to totally agree with her, I also have felt an urgent need to make sure she has what she wants. I am possibly overconscious that this may be her last summer. She mentions it herself, with humor and matter-of-factness, but I am really taking it to heart. I also can't shake this feeling that it may also be my last summer here. It seems likely that we will start to speak of divorce when we return to New York, and I want at least some of what I want. If I will never be close to, if I will never be truly known by this man, if we will never have the parties, the five kids, the fire that burns outside all night long, then the self-bankrolled martyr wants at least a Negroni on the terrace while looking out at the sea, even if she has to make it herself. With only 4 days left of our vacation in the South, before we will have to pack up and head back to Rome, and then back to our lives lived separately in New York, I take the car and drive alone to Tricase, about 20 minutes away, and find the store that has clippers and saws and shovels and rakes. I buy a brand new pair of sharp pruning scissors and a long-handled branch cutter, and while I am there, I pick up packets of seeds for arugula and parsley and lettuce knowing that I will never see them grow in our last 4 days, but reasoning that it will be good to show Marco and Leone how to plant and care for something daily. So I get them anyway. For the next 4 afternoons in a row, when I am finished cooking and while Alda is taking her nap, I climb the trees, sometimes barefoot, with the scissors and the clippers. I trim at least 6 trees, bracing myself in their crotches in the hot summer sun, cursing and grimacing, trying to hold on with one hand and work the clippers with the other. I am 25 feet in the air and can see the sea and all of the life on the promenade. I try to notice where each branch forms so as not to cut the very one I am standing on and plummet to the ground below, but sometimes it's so thick and tangled that I cut with a little niggling doubt hovering over me between my head and the hot sun. When 2 hands are required, I try to use another branch or my own body as leverage, but much of the time I am forced to simply wedge my foot into the tangle of branches below and then just reach all the way out with both hands on the clippers, hoping for the best. Giovanni, in disbelief and I think maybe irritation, looks up from where he is reading on the terrace to discover what all the rustling is in the trees. Regarding my labor, he pauses, sitting still in his chair a moment, letting it sink in that this fucking girl has just climbed the tree and is now pruning it back. Madonna, I bet he mutters. He drops his book in his lap and sits there one more moment relishing, I feel certain, his last few seconds of idleness. And then he patiently lifts himself from the chair and descends the stairs into the garden until I hear him below me, under the trees, dragging away the branches and sawing them into smaller, manageable bundles. I can't see him, but I hear him. It is exhilarating to be so high up, at the very tops of the trees, and to be able to look out at the sea and back at the house completely unobstructed, to have my bare feet wedged into the crotches of tree branches like they haven't been for 30 years makes me feel instantly, kinesthetically, very young again, as if the soles of my feet had memories of their own. Below, Giovanni quietly and deliberately cleans up every branch that falls to the ground. I hear him sawing below. In his undeclared way, he stays nearby to make sure that when the crazy American bird falls out of the tree, someone will be there to pick her up. I laugh out loud from the treetop. Hey, Giovanni, what book are you not reading because of me? Eh, he calls back, and I can hear the smile in his voice. It is his vacation as well, but he has been religiously counting out all the pills Alda must take and gently putting them next to her plate at each meal. He has fixed the electricity, fetched the big glass canisters of olive oil, and made sure there's propane in the stove when I noticed the flames running low. Giovanni seems to truly like the food I've been cooking and jokes at the table one evening, about a week and a half into our vacation, with anchovy butter all over his lips and chin, a pile of shrimp shells and tails on his plate. This can't possibly continue for 3 weeks. On our last day, when Alda comes out onto the terrace after her nap, I can see her clearly from my treetop. She looks confused. Before her lies the sea. Sit down, I yell, waving. Sit! I tell Giovanni to go sit with her on the porch to see if she can see the sea. Dimmi se c'è bisogno tagliare più, I say, butchering the Italian. Tell me if I need to cut more. But the job is finished. I have accomplished a full view. You can sit on the terrace and look out at the sea. Everything feels different. I feel unclenched, thawed out, and hopeful. I have defied the entropy. I descend from the trees and walk up to the terrace to look out. Michele returns home and even manages to compliment my work, modestly. Brava, mamma, he grunts with an exceeding tone, but touches me warmly on the back. Alda is glued to her chair and won't move. I take a seat next to her, equally unable to move. The view is riveting, as if a whole new room in the house suddenly appeared that no one had known about before. The kids run in and out. Michele goes inside to make them some pasta, and I don't budge. Giovanni neatly stacks the last of the fallen branches. The wide-open expanse of sea lies before us, reflecting us. Alda gazes out at the boats coming into the marina for the night, anchoring, and the lights come on along the promenade as the teenagers start to convene in little packs, and the sun starts to set. Michele calls from inside the house, "Mama!" And in unison, we answer, "See?" This is Gabrielle Hamilton. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of Blood, Bones, and Butter, The Inadvertent Education of a Reluctant Chef. This program was directed by Scott Sherritt, executive producer Dan Zitt. This program was recorded and edited at John Marshall Sound. Text copyright 2011 by Gabrielle Hamilton. Production copyright 2011, Random House, Inc. All rights reserved.